when the crows move in, the small songbirds move out. The conquering crows then take over the neighborhood and watch to make certain we behave. At least, so it seems. The brains of these birds leads us to ask, can anyone control the crows?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned in to the 1,050th edition of the Food Chain right here on the GCN Radio Network. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Jason Strubia on the boards. Hello, Jason.
It's a pleasure.
Good to have you aboard. Hey, we have a brand new student intern today, Sarah Rizai. Sarah, say hello. Good to have, well, here, just a sec. Let me push. Okay, now say hello.
Hello, Michael.
Okay, good to have you aboard. Now, Sarah, you have a wonderful little story about your mother told you about crows when she, before she moved from Iran. Tell us the story.
Yes, I do. Actually, my mom would always tell me that crows are thieves. And the reason being when her and her mother would do laundry outside, the crows would always watch over them and wait for the opportunity to steal their soap and their jewelry.
So there you are. So that's how she came to know the crows. Mm-hmm. Well, folks, remember this from Edgar Allan Poe. Once upon a midnight dreary, while I pondered, weak and weary, over many a quaint and curious volume of forgotten lore, while I nodded, nearly napping, suddenly there came a tapping, as of someone gently rapping, rapping at my chamber door. "'Tis some visitor," I muttered, tapping at my chamber door. "'Only this and nothing more.'" Well, turns out there is a little bit more to the tapping at the chamber door than a casual observer might suspect. That thought occurs to me each time I walk the dogs through the neighborhood, a neighborhood now under the control of the Corvidae family of crows, ravens, and jays. I know there is more because the crows have taken to watching me as I make my way with the dogs through the neighborhood. Well, I do once in a while encourage the dog to give the crows a good chase when the opportunity presents, but hey, it's all in fun. And you know, I am a bit resentful at the disappearance of the neighborhood's songbirds, but why would a couple little minor slights like that give the crows cause reason to watch me so intently? Truth be known, I was just getting along with the watching without much to do until sitting down to dinner with some friends. Of a sudden, our host blurted out, "Hey, what can I do about all the crows?" "Are they watching you too?" I asked. And so I kept asking, and most everyone I asked would, after a moment or two of consideration, confess to having had the crows take over their neighborhood as well. All this control being exerted by a family of birds leads us to ask, can anyone control the crows? Well, here to help us today, we have a very, Mr. Crow himself, Mr. Corvid, John Marsloff, who is a James W. Ridgway Professor of Forest Sciences at the University of Washington and also co-author of In the Company of Crows and Ravens. John, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks, Mike. Pleasure to be here.
Good to have you aboard. So, a professor of forest sciences, how did you come to be so fascinated with the Corvid family and crows?
Well, somewhat like you. I mean, they're all around us, so they're very visible. They're performing interesting behaviors and challenging humans as well as other animals. And so they're a fascinating species to dig into. Unlike a lot of birds, the more you look, the more you realize you really don't know about them. So it's stimulating for a biologist to take a look at an animal like that.
And especially, you have a way of seeing them in two kinds of environment. One, of course, that you take your students a lot to Yellowstone Park, which, you know, is probably as close as we can get to nature these days. And you also have a way of observing them on the University of California or University of Washington campus as well.
Absolutely. You get to see them in both worlds for sure. And they can do well in both. Kind of different species in the two places, but still very adept at commanding their environment.
Well, what are the differences in the species? What would make them different?
Well, for example, in Yellowstone, you're kind of a higher elevation, wilder place, and we don't really have crows there very much. There are a few, and they come in the summer, and they're very closely associated with the people that are there around the campgrounds or the developments. Mostly what you have there are ravens, which are a crow's larger cousin. They're same genus, but almost 1.5 times the size of a crow that you're used to seeing.
That's what I was wondering. I remember them so well when I used to spend quite a bit of time running around up in that neck of the woods. I especially remember the ravens in the winter, you know, those great big black birds on the white snow.
Yeah. Yeah, and now in Yellowstone, they're following wolves and making their living off of wolves, so it's quite an amazing scene with the snow, wolves, and ravens.
Mm-hmm. And so they're kind of like cousins to crows, then. Not crows, but cousins to. And are they not singular, or do they not travel by themselves rather than in flocks like the crows do?
Well, there's a bit of a difference in the social structure, for sure. Ravens are much more pair. They're both crows and ravens form lifelong monogamous pair bonds, and that male-female relationship is really the key to their society, both of them. But in crows, some of the younger birds hang around, and they tend to crowd together more closely in their territories and flock together to danger and to good food sources. And in ravens, the pair is very territorial and keeps other ravens out of their space, except for when a big food bonanza shows up. And, for example, if a wolf kill is made, all the ravens in the area will flock to that kill and share the food. And the young ravens, who are kind of vagrant, they don't have a territory, they float around from place to place, they're the first ones in to really flock to these ephemeral food sources.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, we're struck with the notion that when we start considering these birds, the term bird brain just doesn't quite fit for some reason.
Well, it just becomes a compliment as opposed to a derogatory comment. Yeah. Because, they've got huge brains for their body size, much more like small monkeys in that respect than they are other birds. And they use those large brains to good advantage to survive with us and to take advantage of the things we do and avoid the pitfalls we put out in our environment.
So I make the notion that I have become convinced that these birds are watching me as I go through the neighborhood. Is that true? I mean, or am I just hallucinating this?
Well, you may be hallucinating. I don't know you that well, but it's definitely true. They are watching you for sure.
And I suspect because I have my dogs chase them once in a while.
Yeah, and they pick up on that. Any threat to a crow, could be a dog, a cat, or a person, directly, they're going to remember that threat, and they're going to use that information for the rest of their lives, as far as we can tell, and pay very close attention to when that threat's afoot, stay away from it, or even warn and alert others to that threat to come in and learn about it.
Mm-hmm. So then I'm probably in a bad fix with respect to crows for the rest of my life, then, because I'm sure they're just going to be watching me. This is the guy that sends his dogs after us, right? So,
yeah. Stay away from this guy.
Stay away from this guy.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the very basics. What on earth do these animals live on? What do the birds eat?
Well, crows and ravens are very resourceful. They're generalists in that they eat a lot of different things, everything from vegetable to live prey. So they'll dig up roots and things, sprouting plants. They will eat berries and nuts. They will catch mice and snakes and frogs, and they will scavenge anything killed on the roadways as well.
Mm-hmm. I've heard that they'll actually predate on, you know, baby farm animals.
Well, there's been some talk of ravens again. Which are much larger and more carnivorous. And again, as I said, they're really closely associated with wolves and scavenging from wolves. That was their niche.
Mm-hmm.
And in farm areas, there are cases where they have seen ravens scavenging on lambs, for example, or pigs. And the question is always one of cause and effect. Did they cause the predation, or are they just the effect that's scavenging on it? And I think in all the well-documented cases, they are scavengers rather than the predators of those larger animals. It'd be pretty tough for them to kill one unless it was very weak and, you know, pretty much on the way out anyway. They're not that powerful.
And what about the small songbirds of the neighborhood that seems to have disappeared?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that. I heard as you introduced it, and I think this is an important thing to get across. And I think the best analogy is to think about a driver and a passenger. And
oh, can you hold that? We're sure. going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, what happened to the songbirds when the crows moved into town? Michael Olson, this is the Food Chain Radio program. Today we've got John Marsloff, professor of forest sciences and co-author of In the Company of Crows and Ravens and You. 831-479-1080, 479-1080. Have the crows taken over your neighborhood too? Right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5-, 6-, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city.
You can be old or young.
Rich or poor.
Married or single.
You can own land outright.
Or lease it year to year.
You can grow small fruits on prairie bench lands.
House plants in coastal valleys.
Flowers on steep wooded hillsides.
Vegetables in the city green belts.
And ornamentals in neighborhoods of fancy homes.
Get all the help you need to get growing at MetroFarm.com.
Get the complete guide to growing high-value specialty crops for the city at MetroFarm.com.
Get experts to look at your land and assess which crops to grow at MetroFarm.com.
Get advice on how to plan and develop your project at MetroFarm.com.
And get news about the business of farming for the city.
Yes, you can earn a 5-, 6-, or even a 7-figure income by farming high-value specialty crops on a small parcel of land in or near the city.
Grow for the money today at MetroFarm.com. That's MetroFarm.com.
Welcome back, folks. This is the Food Chain Radio program. Today we're taking a step back and talking about some birds. And not just any birds, but the birds of the Corvidae family. In particular, the crows, the ravens, the hawks, or the jays, and the magpies. And I was making note that when the crows moved into our neighborhood, it seems like all the rest of the little songbirds moved out. And that's the question on the table today. What happened to all those little birds?
Well, you're absolutely right. The avifauna, the kinds of birds and their abundance has changed dramatically when we urbanize an area. But it's not so much that the crows have caused this decline, as instead it's really the crows that have gone along with this change that was really really pushed by people and how we've changed our environment. When we come in and clear native vegetation, especially if it was forest or prairie, and we change that to something that's more like a woodland, scattered trees and lawns and things like that that we like, we make habitat that's perfect for crows. That's what they look for. They don't like deep woods or they don't like grasslands, but they like that mix. And when we urbanize an area, we make that habitat for crows. And at the same time, we make habitat that's unsuitable for a lot of our songbirds as well.
Why is it unsuitable for songbirds, though?
Well, we've changed things like the ground cover. We've made a lot of turf instead of a rich mix of forbs and bushes and short trees that a lot of the songbirds require for food and nesting.
Mm-hmm.
So we've changed the habitat away from the things that a lot of our songbirds need and favored another group of them, which includes the songbird, the crow, which is one of the larger songbirds in the world.
Right.
And although
it's not exactly the most beautiful song in the world, but it's certainly an interesting one.
It is. It's a variable. It's more of a language than a song, for
sure. Right, right, right. Yeah. Well, I'd like to talk a little bit about the personality of kind of focusing on the crows. What you said about the difference between ravens and crows was interesting. You have the ravens that kind of evolved with the wolves, I guess, and following the wolves.
Absolutely. That's their strategy. They're very keen on wolf calls. The actions of wolves, they respond to all the signals that wolves give that a kill has been made, and they flock to that kill. And actually, their ability to effectively eat a lot of that dead elk or whatever it might have been, a moose, has probably been an important force shaping wolf pack size. So more wolves are needed to scare away the ravens that come in and try to steal their food.
Mm-hmm. And the crows, on the other hand, you suggest are kind of people birds.
Absolutely, and that's a great way to put it. I think they're doing the same thing with us that ravens are doing with wolves. They basically exploit us. They know all of our signals about where food's going to be and what kind of things are out, what our dangers are, and they take advantage of that information and use it to their own benefit.
Well, you know, being raised in Montana was pretty close to the Crow Indian tribe. And being a big fan, lifelong fan of the Plains Indians, I always wondered why the Crow tribe adopted the name Crow instead of like eagle or grizzly or, you know, something like really dramatic and threatening.
Well, it's a great question. I had the same question, and I went and talked to them about that. And in fact, you were right. They really did adopt the eagle. And they described themselves as a big black bird to some early Anglo visitors. And we interpreted, the Anglos interpreted that as a crow, when in fact it was probably a golden eagle.
Oh.
And so they've kind of been misnamed. And, you know, maybe they've taken on that view now. But if you look at all the symbology of their tribe, it's all eagle.
Okay. But, you know, in thinking about the crow and the behavior of the crows I see, I was beginning to think it's not a bad, you know, name for a tribe of people who just want to take over, I guess. I mean, there's a lot of power in the activity of the crow birds.
Power and ability to adapt. I think you're right. It's a great symbol for a successful society. And the ability to learn from mistakes and adapt to new situations. Crows are expert at that. I'll tell you one group of people that have taken the crow on in this way, and that's the homeless people in Seattle, where I live. They think of themselves as a tribe of crow, and that's because they're making do and surviving on the streets in a difficult situation.
What is it about the crow that gives them this ability? You know, in your TED Talk, you'll make mention of their brain size and in relation to the body size.
Yeah.
And I was introduced once to a friend who raises ostriches. Mm. Ostriches being a great big bird with a very tiny brain. And the owner of these birds was telling the story about how during a recent flood where half of his hill was flooded, he went out to feed the ostriches one day and saw that several of them had waded all the way down to the bottom of the field to where the water trough was. So they were standing neck deep in water trying to get a drink of water. And I'm thinking, boy, that's a real dumb bird.
That's a great anecdote. You know, you wouldn't expect ostriches to be super smart. And in most situations, maybe they don't need to be. That's the interesting thing with brain sizes. It's kind of shaped to the need of your environment. Ostriches are in a pretty stable, more deserty environment. They do the same things all the time. They put all their energy and development into their legs so they can run fast and avoid things, and not so much into the brain. But in a variable environment, like dealing with another social animal, be it a wolf or a human, you need to put a lot of energy into the brain to develop its ability to react to these unpredictable things that social animals like us and wolves do. So that's probably been an important driver of brain size in the crow and the raven. And then the other couple of things that make them, I think, so able to adjust is they're long-lived. You know, it's not unusual out there to have a 20-year-old crow, and there's probably 30- and 40-year-olds out there.
Mm-hmm.
And they're also social. They can learn from one another. So they have a brain capable of learning and forming complex memories like we do, and they can do that from their own experience over a long life or from the experience of watching others get benefits or detriments from doing things during their lives.
Now, I wonder if monogamy has a lot to do with that, with their development skills as well.
You know? Well, it certainly has a lot to do with their ability to adapt, because the pair works as a very efficient unit, for sure. They subdivide work. You know, the female does most of the child care. The male brings food in. They subdivide things. They look out for one another. They team up to take larger prey and things like that. So there's some benefits there, but I think it's the larger social system, you know, having to deal with neighbors and occasional acquaintances that you meet among 10,000 individuals that sleep together at night in a crow roost. Dealing with those big social problems probably drives the brain much like it has driven our brain size.
Just being social animals, you have to have a bigger brain. Just that's all there is to it.
Yeah, there's a lot of information in the social network you've got to be up on.
Well, you make mention of the fact that they can even use tools.
Well, we know that the New Caledonia crow, it's a different species, again, from what we have here in the U.S., but it lives on an island in the Pacific, and that island doesn't have woodpeckers. So there's this empty niche of, you know, insects and things in the ground or in the bark of trees. And that bird makes tools to extract those bugs. It makes complex hooks and spears and makes these out of plant parts. It'll carry a tool around and put it down and come back and get it for another task later. And they're phenomenal. They're probably the most complex tool-making and using animal we know, much better than chimps and other apes, for example.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And then when we're going to take a quick break, when we come back, I'd like to talk about language and the use of language among the birds and how they actually use language to compete, to communicate with people, and sometimes use language to communicate with other critters like dogs at the University of Montana. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson having a little fun looking at the world of crows and how those crows are really taking over our world, because they're just like us when it gets right down to it. They're very social and they love to get around. Do stay tuned, right back with John Marsloff. Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today we're talking about the crows that have taken over our world. And why did they do that? Because they can, and they certainly have the ability to do so, at least so it would seem in my neighborhood. How about yours? Have the crows kind of taken over in your neck of the woods as well? Look around and see what kind of birds you do see. If you see the big blackbirds flying around, I'll bet you won't see a lot of little birds flying around. It's just the nature of it. We have a quick question from our student intern producer, Sarah. Go ahead.
Hi, John. I just have a quick question for you. I was wondering, so humans and crows have coexisted for centuries. Why is it now that they're starting to take over our neighborhoods?
Well, that's a good question, Sarah. I mean, the way people lived on the land early, we didn't have a strong footprint. We had small towns, scattered farms, and right. Certainly there were crows around at that time, and they influenced us dramatically. And we tended to, hate a few as thieves, as you said, from Iran and mm-hmm. other places. But we also revered them for their abilities, and we were motivated by their sounds and their actions. We thought of them as gods and informers in lots of parts of the world. So there were some taboos on some of those animals. And I think as we've changed the world in such a dramatic fashion in the last century, really replacing the land cover drastically from natural to built and farmed, mm-hmm. that has favored the crow. And so their numbers have just exploded because of that massive change.
Hmm. Good. Thanks. Great question, Sarah. Thank you very much. You know, it seems like they're either pets or pests. And one of the things that make them such an interesting pet is that they have language skills. Am I wrong?
No, you're not wrong at all. Their normal calls are quite analogous to our language. Some people would argue that they are true language, but they have symbolic representation of information with given calls. You know, it's not a primal scream of fear. It's a clucking and sounds like that, much like we would use a word to say, you know, danger. They use a particular call to say danger. So the properties of their calls are quite complex. They have large vocabularies of, you know, 20, 30, 40 recognizable utterances that mean different things, and they grade into one another, and they can be combined like we combine thoughts. But what's really fascinating is when they actually use our words to convey information, and they can pick up language from their humans, that especially those that have raised them from the young.
Well, it's not just that they can mimic words, but it seems like they know what the words mean.
Yeah, it's great. This story you alluded to from Montana, there was a guy there who was awakened by his dog barking in the middle of the morning, and he went out to quiet the dog for the neighbor's sake and to get the guy who kept talking to his dog, "Here, boy, come on, boy, let's go," trying to get that guy to be quiet as well. And as he approached his dog's cage, a crow popped up from behind, and it was the crow that was calling to the dog, "Here, boy, let's go, let's go." And the guy was just stunned that this crow could do that. And I guess over the next couple of weeks, this crow was notorious in Missoula, Montana, for going around and rounding up the neighborhood dogs and actually leading them by his voice to the university campus, where he kept them at bay. And eventually, when students would be out and about, the crow would take off and fly, and the dogs would all be chasing after the crow. So maybe the crow found this as either fun or a unique way to get food. But it kind of reminds me of your situation, and I think you ought to be careful with your dog, Michael. You know, the crow could steal it from you one of these days.
Yeah, there you go. Might end up without a dog, yeah.
Exactly.
You know, you just brought up something that really kind of amazes me, is that just the thought of crows having fun.
Oh, absolutely. We know animals play, and they do for the same reasons we do. Some of them very practical, like you can learn social relationships in a friendly setting and practice skills and maneuvers by playing. But they also do it, as we do, fundamentally for the endorphin release in our brain. And that strengthens the function of our brain. It helps make connections between new parts of the brain and helps the growth of the brain, play does. And that's important in social animals for sure. And the crow's not any different than us in that respect. It has the same brain chemistry and the same sorts of releases of endorphins, like relaxing and playing, sliding down snow or pulling string or chasing another animal or maybe calling to a dog or a human. All of those things can have that effect on the bird's brain.
They're kind of like tricksters.
They are definitely tricksters. And, you know, they get a charge out of playing tricks. Basically, they get a rush.
Now, I've heard also that they trade. They understand commerce, where they'll buy food from somebody, for example.
there are some interesting videos of that. The best examples that I know of them trading, there's actually a nice set of experiments done in Austria where the crows and ravens there had to reach out to their keeper and get a rock from the keeper and then bring it back and then give that rock back to the keeper. And in exchange for that little bit of maneuvering, they would get a reward of either cheese or grapes. And for a crow or a raven, cheese is number one, and grapes are not the best food on their list. So they would work really hard for cheese and not so much for grapes. And what was really cool is if they saw the bird next to them doing this trick to get cheese, but they themselves were only offered grapes, they would quit working altogether. And likewise, if the bird next to them was just getting the cheese free without having to do the little rock exchange, they would also quit working. So they're very attuned to who's getting what the value of things are, and what you have to do to get it.
Well, let's go to the phones and see if we can pick up some more crow stories here. Rich, is that you on the line?
Yeah, this is really funny that I picked up, turned the radio on when I did, and I heard these stories because people think I'm nuts about this crow out in my neighborhood. But about 10 years ago, this crow flew into like a window, knocked himself silly, right? And I thought it was dead, but I went over there and I worked on him. I kept stroking him and talking to him. And this is sound crazy, I know. But I actually brought him back, okay? And he eventually popped up, got up, and we've been friends ever since.
Uh-huh. Did he ever bring you any gifts?
Well, I don't know. I don't think so because I have dogs. But he sits on a tree across from me. And when I see him, when we see he just yells at me, and I yell back up to him.
Yeah.
And my friends think I'm nuts, but I said, no, that's got to be the crow that I saved years ago.
Oh,
he's been around ever since. Yeah,
I had a friend who rescued a crow stuck in a fence, and the same sort of thing happened. That crow would bring her food, though, every day. Bits of dead mice and things like that. So maybe your crow's a little friendlier.
Okay, we're going to take you hang in there? We're going to take a quick break, and we'll pick you up when we come back. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Today, we're talking about crows, and you can participate. Pick up your phone, 831-479-1080. You have a good crow story or a good magpie story or have a good question about the Corvidae family, pick up your phone and join us, because we have Mr. Corvid himself, John Marsloff, who is a professor of forest sciences, University of Washington, co-author In the Company of Crows and Ravens, right back. Well, it was an interesting notion. You save a bird, and the bird is your friend. Do birds recognize people? Well, John Marsloff has an interesting story about a mask experiment he conducted at the University of Washington. John?
Yep. We always thought these birds recognized us. You know, just in our normal research, we have to catch them or approach their nest to study them more closely. So we decided we'd test that one time. And what we did is we wore a mask. It was a caveman mask that we originally used when we captured a few birds, 7 birds. And after we captured them with that mask and they saw us holding them and others might have seen the captured birds under the net that we used to catch them, we then walked around our campus, which has 40,000 people, students on it, and we'd walk around with our caveman mask. Or we'd walk around with a control mask that was similar, but a little different, and that was one of Dick Cheney, who was the vice president at the time. And we'd walk around campus with either of those masks, and what we discovered was that the crows immediately responded when we wore the caveman mask, that one we caught them with, what they perceived as a dangerous person. They would scold and attack and dive at us, just like they do to a normal predator of theirs, like a hawk or an eagle. And this has continued and grown, actually, in strength over 10 years now since I captured 7 birds. Now when I step out of my office, which I do once or twice a year with that mask on, boy, the birds are on me. And about, 60 to 80% of the crows on our campus now go after me with that mask. So they can discriminate, they remember, and they've passed on this information amongst themselves because... now, so many of the birds that attack me weren't even born, certainly were not ones that I captured at that time.
So they're just like a population of people, aren't they?
Yeah. The bad news spreads, basically, and they're all informed now that this is a bad guy, and all they have to do is come to the sound that's associated with this this mob that forms around me, and any that don't know come to that mob and they see others scolding and they somehow perceive that I'm the threat and then they learn it from that experience.
Wow. Okay, let's go back to the phones and pick
up. Here we go.
Yes, let's see, we have Mike. Mike, welcome to the Food Chain.
This is Mike and Carmel. I've got a little bit of a story about crows to tell you.
Sure.
I have a wood shop out in Carmel Valley and I was also taking care of a cat for many years on the property. And I used to feed the crows whatever the cat didn't eat. And I found that the crows loved chicken skins and chicken bones. And after a while, the cat moved on, went to another location. And the crows will sit up there and meow. It will make an absolutely perfect meow noise.
Fantastic.
So I keep feeding them scraps, dinner scraps, table scraps. They love nuts and stuff like that.
So what would happen is that the cat would meow and it was time to feed the cat, and so you would feed the cat and then you would feed the crows, but when the cat left, the crows figured out that to get dinner time going, they had to meow.
There's a couple that sit in the tree and meow, and it's the damnedest thing because it sounds exactly like a cat. And also they recognize me by my truck, the color of the truck, and they used to poop on the truck, but once I started feeding them, they stopped. And now they feed, and they feed in absolute silence. once they see there's food on this platform that I have for them, they don't make a peep. They all come down, take the food, and leave.
Well, John, John, you have another story about pooping on trucks, right?
Yeah, it's a great one. That's a super story. I hadn't heard about them associating that sound with food like that, but clearly they do. But yeah, in Sweden, a woman was feeding magpies, similarly to what Mike just described, and the magpies really started to pick up on all of the cues of this woman's activity, and to the point where they would knock on the window if they saw her and even start ringing the doorbell to get her attention to come out and give them food, which she did gladly. And she really enjoyed them. They were fun, but her husband was not so keen on the magpies, and his culture it kind of taught him, similar to the Iran story, that these birds would steal things from you. So he discouraged their presence. He acted as if he threw something at the magpies, and from that time on, they basically whitewashed his car every morning, and they went right for the driver's side window, so that he had to wash it before he could even leave to go to work. And he tried switching positions of his car with his wife's car. They never touched his wife's car. They always got his. And eventually the people ended up moving. And unfortunately, the woman is now feeding seagulls where she lives.
There it goes.
Yep.
So they're an incredible intelligent species of birds, and they seem to be really keyed in on living with people.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the examples we just had show one of the ways they do this, and that is they are very quick to make associations between what we do and what might be good or bad for them of that. And then they remember those triggers for those things. Maybe it's the meowing, or maybe it's the presence of a particular person. But they remember these connections, and that's just, you know, that's a standard memory that they form between some action that's good or bad for them and some signal of that action, whether it's a person or a sound.
Do we see ravens interacting with the city like we do with the crows?
Well, it's starting to happen now in Los Angeles, San Francisco, Anchorage, Alaska, parts of the old world, some of the larger European cities. They have ravens in town, and yes, they do interact with people, and as is the case with most urban species, they become quite tame, and yeah, they don't flush when people get too close to them, because most of the time we don't do anything wrong to them. So, yeah, they're starting to do similar sorts of things.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break. Right back. Do stay tuned. Well, it seems like wherever I look in my neighborhood, I see the crows. Maybe it's because they're following me around and keeping track of me. I don't know. From what Professor Marslov says, it could very well be the case. I'm a marked man.
For sure.
Yeah. And so there I am. But I'm wondering what happened, you know, to the rest of the birds. I think it seems like the crows have become so successful at taking over the environment with us that that's just going to be the way of it. Am I wrong?
Well, yeah, a little bit. And let me give this analogy that I started with was a car. And basically, who's driving the car? Is the crow driving the car that's causing the reduction and extinction of our favorite songbirds? Mm-hmm. And I would say the answer is no. The crow's a passenger along with the other songbirds, and we're driving the car by changing the environment, by putting up very simplified landscapes relative to natural landscapes, by having free-ranging cats, having houses with lots of windows. All these things threaten songbirds and have caused their change. I would add, we've worked on this for quite a while in the Seattle area, and written a book actually called Welcome to Suburbia that celebrates the great diversity of birds that do exist in mm-hmm. our neighborhoods. If we do some simple things, keeping vegetation around and trying to minimize some of those other dangers to them. But it's not really the crows that are driving this, it's us, and they're along for the ride.
And, you know, I think about all of the messes that we make and the garbage that we leave strewn about, and they are opportunists, and we give them lots of opportunity, right?
Exactly. We supplement their life tremendously, and they've taken advantage. And we supplement the life of some other birds and animals, raccoons, things like that as well. And they take advantage of us, too.
Mm-hmm. So we're building this ideal world for the crows. Mm-hmm. And it sounds like what you're saying is that there's going to be a world filled with crows then.
It's going to be. And they're not going to be alone. You know, actually, there's an incredible diversity potential in our cities and suburbs. Mm-hmm. We have to show some restraint. We have to understand the challenges that we provide for those animals, but with some pretty simple changes, diversifying the landscape, small-scale farms, for example, all of those things diversify the area so that more and more animals can find their niche among ours. And I think it's good for us. It soothes our souls as well to have a variety of animals singing and acting around us. And it's good for the environment, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Well, it seems like crows are either pests or pets. And if we want to get along with them, perhaps the best thing we can do is think of them as pets and forget the pest nature of them. And that way we won't have to worry so much about them. But do they really cause all that much trouble when it gets right down?
They cause trouble. You know, they get into... for some reason, they have a fondness for rubber, and they'll pull rubber seals out around cars or doors, even windshield wipers off of cars. So they can be a pest. They can certainly be a problem. And I think if we reflect upon what we've done to tilt the balance in favor of them, that's also a good way to think, if we don't want so many, what do we have to do to our land and the way we live on it to balance things out a bit more?
There you go. Well, John Marslev, professor of forest sciences at the University of Washington and co-author of In Company of Crows and Ravens, thank you so much for joining us. I'll bet you have a lot of fun up there in Yellowstone Park with those kids, don't you?
You bet. Certainly do. Thanks a lot, Michael.
All right. Thanks for joining us. Thank you all for tuning in. Remember Michael Olson's first law of the food chain. Agriculture is the foundation upon which we build all our sandcastles.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.